From the Quackalope Network headquarters, this is the Weekly Quack with Board Game Co., your ultimate source for what's happening around the board game pond. In this week's installment, we're abuzz with Elf Creek's game's latest. We're itching to visit Prague, and the endless winter can arrive any faster.
Hey, everybody, and welcome to the Weekly Quack. I'm one of your hosts, Jam, because in with me is Alexander Sender Ratcliffe III from North Undershire, .663, Jamerson, Peters, Jackson, Harris. And listen, I did that by memory.
Jan, it's too much. Can we just go back to the classic for a moment?
Absolutely
not. What is
the
classic?
Look. With us today is Alex from Board Game Co. and a voice which you might not be familiar with, Jesse Anderson from Quackalope. Nice to be with you both today. I am back. Sam Healy replaced me for a moment, but I have stolen the throne once again.
I just want to be clear. Who is Alex?
You've stolen like 17 halves of my name.
Listen.
Yeah, who is this Alex? I don't know an Alex. I know an Alexander Sender Ratcliffe III from North Undershire, .663, Jamerson, Peters, Jackson, Harris, but I don't know an Alex.
Listen, Alex, Jan, we'll get there.
Theft of my name aside, thank you so much for joining us on today's show. And for those of you who are new to the Weekly Quack, welcome. This is a board game variety podcast organized into three main segments, Shelf or Sell, where we debate whether a game is either entering or leaving our collections, The Medley Minute, a quick reprise of board game news, other musings, and On the Radar, where we discuss upcoming games and why we're excited for them. At the end of-
And most importantly, duck facts and table settings all along the way.
Duck facts are not in this.
No,
absolutely not. But guys,
man, I'm missing Sam already.
He was great, by the way.
I really am. Right? But he never interrupted us. There was no ridiculous foul anything. It was just good-hearted conversation. It was fantastic.
Guys, I brought cookies. I promised our fans after the gummy review from a few weeks back, I promised that this week we would give our concise top three favorite cookies of all time. And so I brought 32 varieties.
That seems overwhelming. But while you get started on those, you can pass one to Jan, have a bite yourself. While I just remind our audience that at the end of every show, we do take time to go through the audience feedback and questions, which is why if you have anything you can participate in, if you have anything you want to ask us, anything you want to talk about, something we talked about in the show, something unrelated, whatever it is, head on over to our website, theweeklyquack.com, and leave your thoughts on today's episode. Before we get going, if you like what you hear here today, be sure to leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts from. And with that, Jesse, have you had a cookie?
Jesse, okay, you brought 32 cookies, but did you bring my favorite?
No. 32 varieties of cookie.
Uh-huh. Did you bring my favorite? Well, we've talked about this before.
Look around the table. Do you see some of your favorites here?
I don't see macadamia anywhere.
Jen, they're right underneath the turtle truffles.
Ooh, this looks good.
Do you have peanut butter chocolate chunk cookies? Because that's my thing.
Peanut butter chocolate chunk that's made by this brand right here and kosher as well.
Excellent. Thank you.
Oh, you sound really good, Jesse.
Jen, lean away from the mic when you're eating. With that said, so for today's episode of Shelf or Sell, the game I'm bringing to the table is Through the Ages. Through the Ages, a new story of civilization specifically, which is the reprinting or the newer version of Through the Ages, the classic game by Vladislav Vatil. And this is a game that, well, it has a legacy. It is currently a game that manages to hold two of the top 100 positions, thanks to the original and new printing. The one I'm talking about
ranked number 6 overall. And rank number 6 as well in strategy.
Which basically tells me that the top 6 games on Board Game Geek are strategy, is it not?
Debatable. I'm actually curious about that.
In any case, Through the Ages, A New Story of Civilization is an abstracted civilization builder, although abstracted is a tough word. This is a game in which you're going to be building your civilization out over 3 ages, plus an antiquity age, and you're going to be doing that by drafting cards from this card row, representing any number of things from one-time use abilities to new technologies, new military forces, new leaders for your civilization, building out wonders. Everything in the game comes down to the management of your actions, the management of those precious few actions you have each turn, and how you're going to turn them into what you need. Along the way, you're going to have to manage resources. You're going to have to manage your population. Again, spending those key actions. Do you grow your population? Do you develop your military might to protect yourself from raids and aggressions, or to perhaps in turn incur your own raids or aggressions? There is so much going on in this game, and by the time those three ages are done, you'll have a good 2 to 3 hours of gameplay under your belt of building out an epic and amazing civilization.
Here, Alex, a simple no-bake, go ahead and catch, while you eat that, I can confirm the top six on Board Game Geek are, in fact, all strategy games as well. Hmm. Here's the interesting thing, though. Two of them, the fourth and fifth location, switch spaces. So it goes Gloomhaven, Pandemic, Season 1, Brass Birmingham, then, depending on which view or which list you're looking at, Twilight Imperium or Terraforming Mars, followed up by our number six, Through the Ages.
That's fascinating.
Alex, I can't imagine you selling this one at all. Like, this sounds to me like you just brought one of your favorite games ever to the podcast just to kind of, like, gush about it a little
bit. I'm not sure that this is one of his favorite games ever. My sense of it might be he could have picked this up to try and wasn't necessarily thrilled about it because he, like us, is doing his best to close the gap in things that he doesn't have knowledge of. And I do have some insight into one of the reasons why Through the Ages has a slightly higher rating than maybe it deserves. Part of it's due to the app variation of this board game. This game specifically has a mix of ratings that relate to both the tabletop experience and the digital one.
This has a digital edition, Alex?
Oh, it definitely does. It has a Steam version, an iOS version, an Android version, multiple options for this. And I believe there's unofficial versions online as well. Lots of options for Through the Ages out there.
All right, I'm changing my mind. His answer confirms he's played it in every single variation possible. He loves this game. He's keeping it.
Hey, I called it first. Alex, what is it going to be?
Well, I love Through the Ages and I'm keeping it. But for what it's worth, I did get rid of it once. I got rid of it after a 7-hour long play. This is like 5 years ago. I got rid of it after a 7-hour. It's actually a fascinating dichotomy of all the things you've brought to this conversation and what I have, which is I love this game. I had this a long time ago. I had the original version. I got the Through the Ages of New Story Civilization. And then 1 7-hour long play in the morning, where we started at 10 o'clock at night and ended at 5 in the morning. I said, this game is great, but it's just too long for what it is.
So, Alex, I also own this game, but it won't surprise you to know I have this game still in shrink sitting upstairs, and I purchased it when I first started Quackalope in a desperate attempt to catch up on all the stuff I just don't know about the hobby. Can you tell me why I should? Can you advocate on behalf of me finally playing this 100%. Game? Because I'll be honest, I glaze over every time I look at that box cover. I feel obligated to play it, but I'm not excited about it.
So what you should do is the same thing I did, which is I got rid of the game. And then once I got rid of the game, I was then willing to buy the app for the first time, because we've talked about this with Galaxy Trucker, but I don't play apps of games in my collection so that I don't further that gap in how good I am at the game compared to the players at my game.
Give me about 30 seconds. Continue talking. I will be back in just a moment.
Excellent. In the meanwhile, download that app. Go ahead and put it on your phone. That app, I started playing it once I got rid of this game, and it reminded me so much of all the things I loved, and I had to get it back, at which point I then stopped playing the app again. But I've been playing it. I've played 3 or 4 games of this in the past month and a half, just as I started to get back into it again, got through those rules, got through that hurdle again. And this game is so good. It's the kind of game, if I don't play it for the next 3 years, I will still keep it, because when I do play it, that civ building experience is so amazingly well done. I know that I have never played another civ game that gives me the developmental feel that Through the Ages does.
And so how exactly does it achieve that? Because obviously the main mechanism here is going to be card drafting, right?
Yes.
I've played a Civilization game. I don't remember the name right now, but it also involved card drafting. I had a lot of fun with that one. But this seems to be like the all-star in Civilization games. So I would love to get a little bit more insight as to what makes it have that status.
Sure. So I think many Civ games get too caught up in that board element, and that having a tactical board. Sid Meier's Civilization, the board game, has that. Class of Cultures has that. Although Class of Cultures is a very good game, don't get me wrong. But they all focus on that board state because, well, it's a Civ game. Of course you have to have dudes on a map on a board. That's what a Civ game is, right? And Through the Ages bypasses that by focusing on your decisions. It's about allocation of actions, allocation of resources, min-maxing your way across three ages, and constantly having to branch out on the things they focus on. They do bring military might to the table in a way that is rewarding and yet not overly punishing. It's a game where you're constantly forced to struggle with what makes the most sense to develop your civilization a drop more efficiently than your neighbor, a drop more efficiently than that player who's trying to attack you. It is so rewarding because every turn you're like, well, I want to do seven different things and I only have four different actions. So what do I do? And how do I get more actions? Maybe I implement a new form of government. Maybe I develop a wonder, a technology. What can I do that will give me more? And everything in this game gives you more. But you have to pick and choose and craft a cohesive strategy across those three ages that will ultimately win you the game or not.
That sounds fantastic. Excuse me, Jan. Let me just slide around and open the window. Moo Moo! Hey, Moo Moo!
Oh, God.
Why would you do
Jesse,
that?
Jesse!
What?
Oh, you said, my God.
Are you getting the app?
Well, yeah. You said get rid of it.
No, I said get the app.
There are components in there that will make the cow sick, right?
No, you said get rid of the game, then download the app. So I've gotten rid of the game. Jan, the cow will consume the cardboard. The plastics, I assume, will be used in a nest for some birds or something outside. They'll be perfectly fine. It is biodegradable, I believe. That's probably... Jan, can you clean up after this show's over?
Oh, God.
I don't want to take care of Moo Moo again.
This is a recorded podcast. I did not say get rid of the game. I just said download the app. Nonetheless, as long as you download the app, I will not complain.
I think problem solved. Jan, what you bring in?
So today I am bringing in a game by the name of Search for Planet X. Have either of you heard of this one?
I have.
I have seen this game sitting in your house.
I have been supremely interested in this game until I saw Components Digital Hybrid App Required. And that's when I lost interest in this game right away.
Here, Jan, slide it over. Let's dig into this Alex while he talks about it.
So Search for Planet X is an app-driven deduction game for 1 to 4 players. In the game, you are astronomers trying to find an elusive planet. The game is divided into 12 or 18 sectors or pieces of the board, each containing a single object with its own rules and conditions that you don't know about. Each turn, you'll choose from 4 main actions, all with the purpose of trying to deduce what's in each one of those sectors and why. Planet X, specifically, is very particular and only exists in a very exact condition. However, determining Planet X's location is not going to be, it's not going to win you the game. As you progress, you're going to need to submit theories confirming the contents of each of those 12 sectors or 18 that we've talked about, which each one is going to give you a different amount of victory points. Whoever has the most points by the end of the game, obviously, wins. And that's Search for Planet X.
I have two
innovative
questions.
Innovative twist on victory.
Two questions and then I'm voting. Have you played Cryptid? And if so, did you like it or not?
I love Cryptid.
Have you played...
I own it.
Have you played Alchemists? And if so, did you like it or not?
No.
I did like Alchemists.
That's 4 questions.
I'm cheating, Jesse. Get over
I'll
it.
I'll allow it.
Okay. But it's 4 questions.
That's fine. I compounded them together.
I would, for the record, I would like to redact the second set of questions.
No problem. I will pretend I did not hear his answer. So...
Okay, thank you.
With that said, now that I have not heard his answer, now I'm only going off of Cryptid and did you like it or not? Ooh, I was hoping you'd say no to those. But either way, it made it a little more complicated. Now, the question is, you clearly like the mechanics presented here, the app deduction, the puzzling nature of finding something out. You like those. The question is, did Planet X hold up? And at an 8.3 rating on Board Game Geek, combined with mechanics you like, you are keeping the Search for Planet X.
Yeah, I'm going to be entirely biased on this one because I was around when Jan had his first experience with this. And while I haven't talked to him about that first experience, I did talk with Sarah Shaw, who is absolutely lovely. She runs Board Games in a Minute. You can check her out on any of the other social media platforms. We're going to have her as a guest one of these days. But she really advocated for this and advocated for it at 2 players, which I actually found pretty shocking for a deduction game of this nature. So my sense of things is if the partner in the play enjoyed it as much as she did, Jan couldn't have been miserable the whole time.
Guys, what are we doing today? There's no cells? There's no cells at all? Jesse, I hope you break
the... We have time.
I hope so, because yes, I am definitely keeping search for Planet X, and actually, it's become easily one of my favorite games. It is incredible.
I want to pinpoint the thing that I'm the most curious about from the very start. You played this two-player, and it is now on your shelf. That, for me, brings up, I mean, that brings up doorbells, because I don't usually find games like this function well at lower player counts. So what's going on here?
Crazy.
What is up with that?
It's actually, so the game is super, super basic in the way that it's executed. Everything is going to be controlled through that app. And even though Alex has a big hesitation around apps, this one really helps and doesn't really become is not cumbersome. Basically, you have a circular board and you're moving a pawn. The pawn is there to just represent turn order. Whoever is farthest back in that circular grid or that circular board is going to have a turn. And every time that you take an action, every action is worth different spaces on that circular board. So if you wanted to look at a lot of sectors at the same time, that's probably going to be worth a little bit. It's going to be worth less time versus looking at two sectors at the same time, which is going to give you even more. So what makes it really interesting is that everything moves at such a quick pace, because anytime you have a question, you input it in the app in less than 2 seconds and you'll get a response. You get a or you get a ding, and it basically starts feeding out that information. What's really interesting about that information is that it really feels like you're discovering celestial bodies. You're trying to understand how they behave and what conditions and what realities or laws of physics are being applied to those bodies, so that you can then start kind of like picking things away little by little. It's really fascinating how it functions. And I think that this is a deduction game that you could technically play by yourself. And obviously it's not going to be as fun because there's not, you know, a competitive element in it, but you could entertain yourself pretty well. And what I love the most about Search for Planet X, Jesse, which I don't think I've seen other deduction games do, for example, Cryptid 100% doesn't do it. The game is not about finding the titular planet. It's about gaining points and knowing what everything is in the sectors.
Interesting. Now, confirming on BGG, this is a 1-4 player game. And in fact, when it comes to where it plays best, the standard rating is none, which gives the inverse of what you'd expect. It actually means that everything is nearly equivalent and spread, and it plays well, as far as the community is concerned, at every one of those player counts, but predominantly at 2.
Oh, is it? It's fascinating. I don't think I've ever seen a deduction game that plays this well. For example, Alex, you asked about Alchemist. I thought Alchemist was a little bit too messy for me. I enjoyed it. I thought it was really a fascinating product. But the result of it and the way that the app integrated itself, I felt was a little bit too cumbersome or too opaque.
Yeah, I thought this fascinating. It's like you said already, like well at all player counts, best at 2, which is shocking for this kind of game. I was not intrigued because of the app, but between this conversation, frankly, I'm putting this on my list of games to get.
Alex, you have to play this.
Ever since I heard about you two playing it, it has honestly been one that I'm excited to get to the table with you, Jan. I can't wait to have a moment to sit down and figure out what you're excited about here.
Dude, like the main reason why I think it's so good is because the mechanical aspects of it are so basic, but the intellectual and logic puzzle of it are so heavy. In order for you to figure out what's going on, you have to try and understand logic rules. You have to try and start taking things out. The balance is so, so good.
And as a last touch of insight before I get into the game that I'm bringing onto this shelf or sell segment, I also know that you're talking about this game within the context of losing.
Why do you have to bring that up? What's the point?
Thank you, Jesse.
Because I know Sarah listens to our podcast, and man, she beat us at like 3 or 4 of the 5 or 6 games we played this weekend.
Hey, I won one time.
Listen,
at least.
All I'm going to say is QuackCon 2020 was a glowing success, and we're currently prepping for QuackCon 2021.
Are you seriously telling me that you had something that you're calling QuackCon 2020 and I wasn't invited?
You're always invited, Alex.
You were invited. You just weren't there.
The first I'm hearing about QuackCon is right here on this podcast.
Well, standard differences. I mean, that's going to be an interpretation of language. You have a standard invite to everything that I am ever doing for the rest of my life. So,
I forgive you. That was
sweet.
And
just to clarify, On our Discord, there's right now QuackCon 2021. It's already been announced.
It's the new prep zone. Sender, you're behind the times.
I feel left out. I feel like I'm gonna. Can I take a break from this podcast? I'm gonna hop on over to Discord. Jesse, you can talk about your game. I'll be right back.
Take a cookie with you as you go.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
I am bringing in a little game that's been buzzing around and delivering itself to various different Kickstarter backers over the last, or at least approaching over the next month.
I heard the
I'm
word
bringing
buzz.
In a beautiful little game called Honey Buzz.
Ooh, I know this.
Honey Buzz is a long-awaited game from Elf Creek Games. It is a game of spatial tile placement, it is a game of resource management, and it is ultimately a game of selling all of your honey to the bear market or the animal market, doing your very best to score as much wealth or gold or resources as you can by the end of the game. It is that standard approach. You know, we all know the saying, if you have a beehive and you're concerned about the bears taking the honey out of your beehive, start a brand new entrepreneurial program where you set up beehive honey selling stands to sell to the animal folks so that they purchase and consume the honey instead of stealing it from you down the road.
Obvious.
It's one of those phrases. I mean, it is one of those standard things that I'd say a lot of board games are inspired from. Yeah. This one just did it directly and literally. Throughout the course of the game, you're going to be using worker placement beeples to go to different regions and collect different pieces of your honeycomb. You're then going to be building out a spatial puzzle, a honeycomb puzzle, trying to figure out how to build little nodes. These nodes are going to be able to contain different types of resin. That resin is then going to produce honey from gathering and collecting the pollen that's necessary. The interesting thing about this game is the combination of worker placement mixed with spatial puzzle solving, mixed with activating certain actions every time you complete one of those nodes. You see, every time you fill in a little piece of your beehive, you're going to be triggering a chain of actions that you can then take, whether that is selling things to the market, moving to collect pollen, producing honey, taking a random wild action, getting coins immediately, little acorn wooden pieces. There's a lot going on in this game, and the end of the game is going to boil down into that marketplace that I was talking about, selling and producing as much resource as you can and generating as much victory points or wealth as you can before the four seasons come to an end.
Hey, I'm back. Hi, guys. First of all, QuackCon, I'm a little upset none of you have told me about this. Jesse, have you announced your game yet? What was your game?
Honey Buzz.
Oh, isn't that the one with small, adorable creatures?
With beeples.
You're keeping it. Done.
Oh.
Yeah, Jesse, there's no mystery here, man.
Why?
I'm pretty sure you're
what
keeping
do you
this
mean?
One.
Why so quick to judge?
I'll repeat my question. Doesn't it have small, adorable creatures?
Yes.
Okay, you're keeping it.
That's a great point, too. Like, you Jesse, love anthropomorphic creatures all the
can
time.
You
it's your
tell
number
me
one thing.
A single game with small, adorable creatures that you have gotten rid of?
Yes.
Go ahead.
Mm-hmm.
I'm waiting.
Mousetrap.
Fine. You're still keeping this one.
I'm pretty sure it's still in his closet.
Yeah, it is.
So, Jesse, are we right?
You are right. You are right.
Yeah,
I had a chance to play
it
this over the weekend as well. And I really, really like what's going on here. Now, there is a caveat to that statement. There is a version of this game that I don't think I like. And it is when you flip the honey that you can collect or the resin that you can collect, you can flip those to make a memory part of the game where you're flying around and doing your best to pick certain flowers that contain a percentage of different types of pollen for you to then, you know, proliferate or pilfer your
I thought
your
they honey.
My understanding is they had a variant.
It is a variant, yes. So there's two different options, but the advanced mode of this game includes that memory element, and the non-advanced mode of this game, you just have everything exposed, and so it's more about flying and puzzling where you're going to go as opposed to remembering everywhere you need to be.
Yeah, I prefer the former.
Instinctively,
I didn't feel like it really needed that memory element. Nope. And I know some people might enjoy it, but it didn't improve the game for me.
No, 100%. I actually played this back in PAX Unplugged last year, and I had a good time, but I remember particularly that board right there just really didn't add anything to the conversation or to my enjoyment of that game. It felt a little bit random in a game that's all about like cold calculation and trying to be very efficient with your turns, and having to spend one of your beeples to go there to just completely not get anything felt so horrible.
Yeah, what I like that's going on here in Honeybuzz is first off going to be the adorable anthropomorphic animals. I mean, they are just so, they're so handsome. The bear is walking up to the lemonade stand and purchasing honey and straddling away. You can't beat adorable animals every day of the week. But when it comes to the actual gameplay, the flow of play, I like the decision space of the worker placement, and I also like the decision space of this honeycomb you're actually building out. Let me dig into those just a little bit more. In the worker placement location, instead of having places closed off when you go there, you're actually able to go to every region at any time you want. The only thing is, it's going to cost you slightly more when you go to that region after you or anyone else has already been there. So you're always weighing...
Painful.
You're always weighing the odds. The first time you go, it's going to be one beeple. Second time, two beeples, three beeples, four beeples, and you're slowly going to run out and have to recall your workers. But recalling actually isn't so bad, because when you recall, you get to pollinate. You get to bring some resin back into your honeycomb and potentially progress the game in a positive way. So there is this nice give take between who has first player, who took what action, who went to a zone that made it slightly more costly for you, but also gave you the opportunity to recall your workers slightly before them.
Man, and I gotta say, I am digging this tradition of not heavy, but economic games incorporating tile laying or pattern building in some capacity.
Yeah, 100%.
Because this is stellar. Like, we got Pipeline now, Honeybuzz, and I'm pretty sure I'm missing like two more that have come out, but they all feel so very different and unique.
So,
and I remember really liking Honeybuzz in that way.
That's the second thing I want to talk about. Probably the most interesting or rewarding part of this game. When you are placing your beeples up in that top zone, you're doing so to collect a series of very similar tiles. In fact, I believe there are six total options of different honeycomb pieces that you can add into your tableau. And the reason you're doing this is that each one of these contains a different icon. This is going to be a different action you get to activate when you finish building out a little node. Now, that puzzle is really cool, because
it's,
you
so
usually can trigger
too. Two
or three or four different things, and you're paying attention to what type of node you're building so you can get the right pollen and the right honey that you want to fill that space. You're paying attention to what you need to trigger so you don't waste any of your activations when you finally get it linked in. And you're also trying to pay attention to where you're going to be gathering or scoring your points. Do you go for a high market value? Do you try to sell into the market? Or do you focus on triggering things early game that give you newbies or immediate payoff, but might not be quite as valuable towards the later stages in the game? That little spatial puzzle transformed this game for me.
Yeah, it looks beautiful. This continues the trend of Elf Creek games continuously having these amazingly overproduced, beautiful, gorgeous games. And I mean, I don't know. I think every single game on the shelf, from my own to your games, I want them all.
And Jesse, before we go, I need you to do something for me.
What?
Say Beeples five times fast.
Beeple, 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 beeple.
Settle down, settle down. It's time for our Medley Minute, a moment of respite before the rest of our show.
Beep, 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 beep,
okay,
beep,
Jesse,
beep,
Jesse, beep. Okay, that I only said five. I didn't say 400, man.
Beep.
Let's, okay, good job. You did it. You got great pronunciation. Now, do you happen to have a cookie that is based off honey?
Oh, yeah, these honey-drizzled hazelnut shortbread cookies right here.
Oh, my God. Give me that entire plate.
Here you are. Sender, while Jan's distracted, what are you bringing in for your Medley Minute?
So I'm bringing in less of a
Jan,
piece of news.
Away from the microphone. Seriously, I'm not bringing in lasagna if you continue eating so close to the microphone.
Final stop. Jesus.
Less of a piece of news and more of a, well, conversational piece, really, which is, I was watching this interview with Eric Lang on Board Game Revolution, and they were talking about the concept of how board games haven't really developed IP in the way that other things have. And the specific example they gave is, so if you're thinking of video games, we have like Super Mario or any number of the Prince of Persia character. There's any number of popular IP characters in the video game universe. But are there any board game characters that have their own level of renown?
Yeah, Frank from Guess Who? What are you talking about?
I don't know if many people know Frank the same way you know Frank, Jesse.
What about the titular character from HeroQuest, the barbarian?
What's his name?
Isn't that like a Joe?
Whoa. Oh, I've got it. The broadsword.
Yeah,
that's it.
I don't know. Maybe you can count whoever you want. This is more of just a conversational, I guess, something to think about. But like, I started thinking about it, and I couldn't think of anyone that resonates as a popular board game character.
Cthulhu. Cthulhu's a popular board
Cthulhu's
game character.
Not from board games. It's board games
a board
adapting
game character. So here's what I would say around this thing. I think the current age of board gaming that we're in right now is a fairly new thing for this hobby. You know, you have Mr. Mario Man. I mean, that would be a classic contemporary board game figure that entered the popular zeitgeist, right? I would say that he is a iconic figure. But
what is it, Mario Man?
Who's Mario Man?
No, sorry, not Mario Man. Mr. Monopoly.
Oh, Mr. Monopoly. Yes, that's fair.
That's
so,
a good
so
one.
He would be I'm kind a of upset classic. That that's the one that made it.
Well, but he would. But the reason being, and here's what I was getting to. He actually looks a lot like Mario as well. I wonder if they're inspired from each other. Either way. Here's what I was getting to. I think that for a character to become iconic in the same sense of Mario and Yoshi and things like that, a generation almost has to both be impacted by them and grow up with them so that they're looking back on them with a suite of nostalgia, whether that nostalgia is a couple months old or predominantly quite a few years old. And right now in the board game space, we're both not large enough in terms of the wider fan base, and we also don't have enough history to really have a cultural and kind of generational impact in the same way that some of those iconic video game characters and other IPs have had. Do I think we'll get there? And do I think focusing on brand identity in that sense could be important and valuable moving forward as our space grows? Probably, but I'm not surprised that there's not a lot of IPs that exist in that way. I don't think Mario, when he first was created, was designed with the intention of becoming a staple in the video game space. Instead, he was just this little, overall wearing guy climbing a mountain going up against Donkey Kong, or climbing some pipe rail going up against Donkey Kong, and a generation connected with it. And that's where Nintendo then took and built a brand.
Yeah, but the interesting thing about that is that, the board gaming hobby has been going on for over 40, 50, heck, for basically the same amount that Mario's been out there.
But not in the same scale and not in the same way. We are now seeing, and one of the things that I find the most fascinating about our industry is the development of brand new board games is largely being inspired from the new technology and the new way we approach game design in the video game space. There is so much crossover and actually so much adaptation in the tabletop industry that you never saw in generations past. And so I think that iconic figures like Mr. Monopoly exist because that one game did break through something.
But one thing you're leaving out is how many characters can you name from board games? Forget the impact. Can you tell me the name of a single character in a board game that resonated with you?
He did Mr. Monopoly. That was a really good
Aside from Mr. Monopoly, forgetting for a second the lasting impact, you've been playing board games for years now. Tell me a single character that you know their name.
I mean, I could list all the people from Kingdom Death. I mean, we have Alistair. We have Zachary, we have Alistair. Like, those are, for me, degrees of iconic characters. When people ask me what my favorite models in the Kingdom Death lineage is, it is that starting White Lion and four characters. But that is a niche community that won't become a cultural staple. You know, thinking through other things, you can think of the Nemesis figure, you can think of some of the people you roleplay. I'd say D&D has more characters that are potentially, through Critical Role, bridging that gap.
Look. I have a character for all of you, and it's actually a video game character. Today, I am bringing in Hades. Hades is a roguelike video
Hades
game.
Hades is not from a video game.
Yeah, that's...
He's like, this is a Greek myth. I mean, Jen.
Greek god.
Yeah, yeah, but the game is called Hades, and one of the characters... Okay, fine, I'll give you that. The character that I was going to introduce is called Zagreus.
I mean, I'm significantly more interested in the point I was making.
No. So, Hades is a roguelite video game by Supergiant Games, and you are Zagreus, the son of Hades. After discovering some dark secrets about your past, you make a decision to leave the underworld, to never come back. However, you soon discover that that's not as simple as it seems, and this game is freaking amazing.
Why are you pitching a video game?
Yeah, and there you go, Alex. The next iconic figure in both the board game and video game world, Zagreus.
Come on, it's an easy one to pronounce.
Zagissus.
Jesse was just making a comparison about how video games are breaking through the zeitgeist of board games and how they are influencing how we make and approach design today. Of course, I'm going to bring in a video game.
No. I made that opinion long after you chose to bring a board game into a board game podcast.
Yeah. This is Medley Minute. This is supposed to be just a topic and musings. I'm bringing in a musing, and I am very amused by Hades. It's a wonderful game. You guys should really check
it out. Medley Minute is not relaxing me this time. What I'm bringing in is a brand new game designed and implemented by Shut Up and Sit Down. After they preached so highly of Blood on the Clock Tower, which was a abject failure in my book, and yes, I have played it 3 to 5 times, I can't say I'm not skeptical of their brand new Kickstarter, Don't Get Got. I didn't want to bring it in as a main featured. I thought I'd bring it in as a Medley Minute for two reasons. I'm going to pull back just slightly. I like, you know, making fun of Shut Up and Sit Down because I want them to notice me sooner or later.
Great strategy.
I figure it'll work one of these days. But I really do like the concept of Don't Get Got. And every time I've played it, Jan, with you, with our gaming group in DC, it has been a riot. I don't know what the new things that they're adding are, but part of me wants it despite the fact that I'll never get to the 100 extra cards.
Yeah, well, you're going to have Quinn's super sharp humor, so that's something to look forward to.
I'm actually very curious to see if their set of cards are more dynamic or interesting than the original core. So, I think their version of the game might be better.
I can't speak for Don't Get God, but I can tell you with monikers, while I thought the moniker Shut Up and Sit Down, you know, set was fine, I didn't think it was, like, better. I thought it was good.
Interesting.
I feel that this new set is going to be obviously more catered to board gamers. I saw they did a little video, and one of them is a Kickstarter. So it's probably get your friends to talk about a recent Kickstarter or something like that. That's probably one of the get gots.
Y'all heard it here. Shut Up and Sit Down. Basically wrong on everything. All right, guys, I am excited to be to this stage of the podcast because this is where I take the time to inform you, as you guys munch down on cookies, that ducks also have an interesting way of consuming their food. Did you know the omnivorous bird also tends to consume gravel, small stones, or sand, not for their nutritional value, but because they have a little thing called a gizzard? They store those little bits of rock, pebble, and other grain to actually digest and help break down the food that they're eating. So if a duck was eating a cookie, it would first go through its gizzard where there's a rock that helps digest it. That's the easiest way I know of to remember exactly what a gizzard is.
That sounds disgusting. That was horrific.
Been your foul moment.
So first peas and now a friggin' shredder in their mouths? This is ridiculous.
Ducks are fascinating, Jan. And
they start speaking
there's
no
reason
like
they
aliens.
Like peas so much is that they're kind of sick of eating cookies mixed with rocks.
They're extremely green. That's my theory as to why they like peas. All that being said, Jan, speaking of other things that are highly fascinating, can we get through your on the radar so Alex and I can talk about ours?
Wow, really? My
that
God.
That was harsh, Jesse.
Look, you're both wrong for not being interested in this, because this is going to be a fantastic game. Today, I'm talking about Praga Kaput Regni by Vladimir Suki. Okay, this is an action selection game, Euro, based on building the medieval city of Prague during the reign of Charles IV. Players are going to take the role of wealthy citizens, funding projects across the city to gain favor with the king. Players will choose among six main action tiles that constantly rotate on a wheel, shifting their costs and benefits along the way. Your actions are going to consist mainly in upgrading your personal player area, building the main city, or going up certain tracks to gain points or other bonuses. The player who impressed the king the most wins. And by the way, if you don't know who Vladimir Suki is, he, and I'm probably butchering this name as I butcher every other name, he's one of the designers, well, he is the designer of Underwater Cities. So he is definitely somebody to keep on your radar.
Yeah, he has five games in the top 1,000. He has, like you said, Underwater Cities is his highest rated game. He's done Last Will and the whole Last Will trilogy or doubling.
Prodigal's Club or something
exactly.
Like that.
Yeah, he's definitely someone to be aware of. And that would be the only, I guess, Praga Kaput Regni is a game that has not been on my radar, so to speak, except for the fact that, I mean, Vladimir Suchi, his name is in and of itself a reason to be interested in any game.
Correct. And so here's the thing. Like, first off, I saw the cover and I actually really liked what I saw on that cover. And then I learned that was, you know, Vladimir Suchi. When I started digging into the game, which was very recent, I started to see a trend that this actually looked like one of the most complex games that he's made so far. And surprisingly so, he seems to believe the same thing as well. So Vladimir Suchi is actually from Prague. He grew up his entire life there, and he was enamored with historicity throughout his entire career. And one of the first games that he ever brought was based on kind of like that historic lineage that he's always wanted to bring into board games. However, as time went by, like his notions and his ideas of coming up with some type of Euro or game based around history kind of went to the background. After finally finishing up the Underwater Cities expansion, this was the time that he can finally bring his beautiful Prague into board game form. And he made a dev diary recently, which is actually the first time that I've been able to internalize what Praga Kaput Regni is. And I was fascinated. Basically, we are all working together to build Prague, which is, you know, renowned for being one of the most beautiful cities in the world. And you're going to do that by building the gorgeous bridge that they have, the cathedral. There's the Hunger Wall. There's the main city. There's so much here. And what makes it really, really friggin' cool are obviously the mechanics, right? Because everybody knows that I'm not really a thematic person, but I appreciate the thematic tie-ins and how he's brought them together. The mechanics here that I kind of alluded to in the main intro is that there's a board with six tiles, right? And you basically what you do is that you just select a tile and you do the thing. However, what's really neat about this board,
those mechanics,
is that
Alex, select that
what's
tile,
really neat,
do that thing.
What's really neat about this board is that it's constantly rotating. And the idea is that any time that this tile rotates and somebody doesn't use a particular tile because they're all aligned, you know, in one in order, things are getting better and better and better. So players might see a tile right now with some type of action. They're not really interested. And as people start ignoring it, it suddenly becomes something very, very valuable. That also ties into tile laying on your personal player board that gives you better powers. There's also tile laying on a shared board, also building up different pieces of the entire map. It's crazy the amount of stuff that's in this game.
Yeah, Jen, I thought it was interesting that you said the box cover is the first thing that kind of piqued your interest, and then the designer, and then now digging into the mechanics. And I'm just sitting here looking at the first stage of that equation, and I sort of agree with you. I dig what's going on here. I think aesthetically it looks very interesting, and you talking about this idea of a rotating tile sort of rondel system where I'm not activating on a rondel, instead the board itself is moving in that kind of form. I think that sounds neat as well. Like, you've definitely piqued my interest around wanting to play this. How do I get my... Is it even available?
Yes, actually. So, as
because
I mentioned before...
You do have a history.
No. I've been doing my research. Praga Kaput Regni has been completely under wraps for a long time now. And very recently, I think Slicker Drips posted a review or a playthrough about a week ago at this point. And the reason why that's happening is because I believe that the game is coming out now for pre-orders in all major areas, right?
Oh, nice.
And I'm pretty sure, I'm calling it right now, I think Praga Kaput Regni is probably going to be one of the all-star Euros of the year. Like, I really do believe that it's going to be talked about a lot. People are going to be very excited about it. Everything I've seen from the playthrough looks fantastic.
What's making you say that?
A note to the calendar, 8 months in advance. Is it all-star of... Okay, go ahead, Jen.
No, but I want to disagree with that because I don't think it will be. I think that, I mean, unless it's something more you're basing it off, while the name will carry it far to a degree, I think the name, well, when I say the name, I mean Vladimir Suchi, I think the name of the game itself is actually not a selling point. It's a little bit more of a hurdle to remember, to recommend, to easily say. The game itself looks like, I mean, it could be amazing, but the board, the art, the tiles, nothing really immediately calls to mind what's distinguishing this game from others.
Well, I'm talking mechanically. I've seen the game in action. I've seen almost the entirety of that Slicker Drips playthrough, and I've read through the dev diary, and it really does seem like it's going to be a fascinating Euro. Does it do something that I've never seen before? Debatable. I think that the combination of elements that it's bringing to the table is really fascinating. Like, coincidentally, like we talking about Honeybuzz, the way that you get your improvement tiles is that you kind of have your own personal hexagonal board that you're kind of adding pieces to in order to activate different things and get better combos. So I think it's really more a perfect mixing of kind of this disparate pieces that is going to make this one special. And the way that he was able to get everything working, especially what he calls the action crane, which is that main board. I think that's going to be kind of like one of the stellar pieces and actually one of the more innovative aspects of this particular game. So yes, I do believe that it is going to be a hit.
Listen, I hope I'm wrong. I'd be very surprised if it broke top 500, and I think even top 1000 might be... I hope I'm wrong. I hope I'm wrong.
Yeah, I'm excited to see, and I'm glad I put a note in my calendar for 8 months from now for Alex or Jan, one of you, to be severely wrong, or it could just kind of be okay in general, like most games are. I am bringing in a current Kickstarter, which we did some coverage of on the channel, which Alex has also dug into a little bit. And Jan, this is one that I've had multiple requests for a gameplay with you because people want to see you dramatically fall apart to the center of the...
Likely.
It's one of the things that people enjoy the most, specifically I enjoy the most when I play games with you. I'm bringing in a little game called Veiled Fate.
Uh-huh.
This is by IV Games. And this is a game of strategic deduction, a game where you're playing as various gods, all trying to influence this board of demigods, your children that are going on missions, going on quests in a Herculean fashion, doing their very best to position themselves around the board state or around the map so that they can gain as much renown as they're able to by accomplishing or having fate kind of be on their side. The object of the game is to lead your demigod, lead your child to a position where they can join you in heaven, climb those golden steps and ascend the throne and be immortalized forever while leaving your opponents in abject poverty and suffering. At least that's my sense of it. This is called a strategic deduction game for a very specific reason. It is a game where the gameplay itself does not rely necessarily on the social deduction element. But social deduction is something that you can utilize to maybe get a foothold above or do a little bit better than the people you're playing with. There is a strategy, there is a game, there is a tabletop experience that you're playing. You're not just gazing across the room into someone's eyes saying, "Are you the werewolf? Because you done look like a werewolf." Instead, you're moving and maneuvering figures. You're all playing with this different series of cards and quests, all doing your best to take actions with every available unit. And at the same time, you're trying to read what the motivations of other players' choices might be. Who might be their demigod? Who are they trying to get to ascend the steps? And are they trying to divert you or direct your attention towards someone who they really don't care that much about? I also have to say I'm a little biased in favor of talking about this game, because if they hit a million on Kickstarter, I get to write an entire lore book for all of the different quests and the demigods, and it's going to be a beautiful art book, and we're going to put it together, and I'm going to cry.
Well, the $1 million aside, which I definitely hope it happens, I would love for you to write a giant lore book and whatnot.
Thank you, Alex.
I would. I support look, your dreams, Jesse. I support your
I
dreams.
I have a dream that has been birthed in me from the early days. I want to become a flavor texter.
Because that's the official term that writers use, correct?
No,
yes,
no, flavor texter. No, I don't, not a writer. I, Jesse Sender Radcliffe III, would like to become, what?
Is that why you stole my name? Is that why you decided
you to
take
apart
it from my name at the beginning of this episode?
I, Quackalope, shall doth write flavor text.
Well, you're doing great so
and
far,
I shall
buddy.
Doth write
doing
great so far. The most amazingeth of warteth.
Alex,
so Veiled Fate.
Setting it aside,
Veiled Fate is a game that I am supremely intrigued by because, and this is something I talked about in my video I did of it, but basically it reminds me of a game called Clans. And Clans was a game that very much had that strategic deduction element, although I believe IV Games is the one that came up with the official term. But Clans was very much a game like that, where it was about the strategy, about the movement, about how to play a game well. But the deduction heavily played into how well you could mask yourself from others and how well you can deduce the moves that others would make. So it's a combination of both. You need to be adept at both, but you don't need to excel at either. You can either be particularly good at one, particularly good at the other, or just a good combination. And I loved the promise or the premise of what Clans did. I just thought the actual strategy part of the game was on the weak side. It was an okay mechanism combined with an interesting combination of aspects. And if Veiled Fate does what Clans did, but better, then I'm incredibly interested. That's basically what I'm hoping for.
I don't have familiarity with Clans itself, but what I can say about Veiled is it is simple and accessible in terms of the strategy that you're deploying. So you don't have to read into a lot of different mathematic equations to figure out what's going on. But that simplicity still gives you a decent amount of choice and agency over the actions you're taking. There's a lot that you can do personally because there's so many different pawns to maneuver around. And it also gives you a lot of opportunity to easily read into or think that you're easily reading into the motivations of the other players around the table. When you sit and look at this game, there's one element that I think I would describe. I mean, it is a beautiful and clean game. From the art style to the production quality to the way the cards and graphic design is layered on, all the way to the board game mechanics and the actual design style of it, this is a game that you can tell is designed by a animation studio, which is fascinating and also really exciting. The prototype that they sent me is probably one of the nicest prototypes I've ever received. It is, in all essence, a finished copy of their game. Outside of course, the wooden board, which I also would really like if they're listening to this, please.
So my main question comes from, I always get a little bit hesitant whenever I hear strategic deduction or hidden identity game. I know for a fact that obviously the main mechanism in this game is that everybody shares the same pool of idols or gods and everybody's moving these gods in order to complete different things. How exactly is that going to add strategic depth to hidden identity games?
So the question is where and how you're maneuvering these different gods, because the primary objective is going to be either moving them into the city to gain a immediate benefit or placing them on quests in different zones and regions that once those quests complete could lead towards them getting a benefit, a boon, you getting a benefit. There's a variety of different things that could be accomplished there. And so as you're placing them, as three or four of these demigods are venturing out on a quest, you're also placing down a series of cards called fate cards. These cards are going to influence those quests and the outcome of those demigods that are journeying out. If it is in their favor, they may get a curse or a boon. If it is against them, so light and dark, scorpion and feather. And depending on how that hidden deck of agency, that hidden fate deck resolves, that is what's going to happen to the demigods that were placed. So you can visibly see the action that I'm trying to take. Then you can infer the cards that I might have placed. And then finally, when you see the result, you start making guesses. Maybe I did want purple to go gain those two victory points. Maybe I moved black into the city so he'd be ready to take another quest. There's a lot of little things that you can read into throughout the course of this game.
So that's interesting. Like, this reminds me of a game. Alex, I'm not sure if you've heard of this one. It never really got very popular. I'm not even sure if it released. It's called Slyville.
Nope.
And it's very similar in the way, because in Slyville, you have a semicircular board. You're going to different sectors. Everybody's putting in different cards, and each of those cards is going to bring you different resources and different things that you're trying to achieve. And if you're able to anticipate what your enemies are doing or your opponents are doing, you're able to get better outcomes of that. I thought that was a really cool take on hidden information. It wasn't hidden identity, but hidden information. So you've piqued my curiosity about this one for sure.
Jen,
yeah,
your curiosity was piqued because I'm promised to write flavor text. Jen, my dream.
My personal favorite part of Clans, I can't speak for Veiled Fate, is when the color that has the most points that wins isn't any of the players playing the game.
That's totally possible. That almost happened in the gameplay that I still have.
It's like you have this collective aspect of different players driving a game, and throughout that collective whatever, you manage to have someone else entirely win, which is fascinating to me.
Yeah. So, Alex, before we move on to your point, I did promise the audience one final take from kind of my section here. And here, I've saved these for the very end. You all have tried most of the flavors at this point, so you've already cataloged like what you like in your mind. Here are my three all-time favorite cookies. Let me know your thoughts. We have the lovely and beautiful and refined thin mint. Absolutely delicious.
Mm, that's slide it across.
Absolutely. Here's an entire case, and I did go with the Girl Scout version of Samoa's.
Samoa's, ooh, no, now
yes, Jen, 100%. I love Samoa's.
I am liking you, Jen. You and I.
Yeah, I told you, Alex. We're very similar, man.
And then finally, here is chocolate chip toffee cookies. Y'all ever
those
had those
okay.
before?
Those were okay.
Yeah, those are fine. Yeah,
not toffee, but at least not Thin Mints.
I like.
They
the,
just feel
I
like they're
going to
break
saltiness.
My teeth at any second.
Well,
that's the issue with them.
Yeah. Well, we've personal stories and all that.
Hey,
listen,
but you
to,
did say
you
Samoa's.
Said Samoa's. You get a pass in
yeah,
Samoa's.
Yeah. You survived this round. You said Samoa's. Good job.
Although
good job.
I'm a little disappointed in a top three list of cookies, you managed to get two Girl Scout cookies in there. Like, do you have no creativity?
No. Thin Mints do not have to be Girl Scout only.
It's semantics. Nonetheless, I will go into my
game. Samoas do have to be Girl Scout versions.
I've eaten Samoas that are not Girl Scouts, and they're still amazing.
The two of you. I will go into my game of the week, my On the Radar, which is a game that, and Jan, I apologize in advance, because this is actually a Kickstarter from next week. So our audience will have to wait a whole 4 or 5
wow.
days.
I'm wow.
basically
wow.
breaking
Send
the rules.
Send me stuff every
Holy
time.
Cow. That's convenient,
you?
Though, because next week we're going to have a slightly different episode. So, way to think ahead, Sender.
That
I'll
is
admire
my plan.
Your...
Why would you commend him on
because
this?
Because I wanted...
You're breaking rules!
No. I am so excited about Endless yeah. Winter that as soon as I realized I would not be able to cover it next week, I was willing to break the rules, violate things, become even a hypocrite, so to speak. Because I want to talk about Endless Winter.
And that's going to be the show. Thank you so much for joining us. So glad you could be a part of this. Stick around. Make sure you go swing over to theweeklyquack.com. Leave a comment letting us know your thoughts. What are we right about? What are we wrong about?
Jesse.
And stick after the commercial break for the comment section of this
Do
podcast.
Do you know how disconcerting it is when you are not in control of your own production and people can do stuff like that to you? It is not fair, Jesse Anderson. Jesse Anderson, Samuel, Quackalope, something.
What do you think, Jan? Should we let him talk about Endless Winter?
Come on, man. He's so happy. Like, look
all
at him.
Right,
he's practically glowing.
Okay. Go ahead.
First of all, I will note for the record that all three of us have played Endless Winter. And if I'm not mistaken, when we played it together, Jesse, you won, which is annoying. But anyways, Endless
yes,
Winter. Endless Winter.
He did cheat. He did kind of get an exploit, and I would have technically been way up there too.
I believe that as soon as they played that game, they said they're still tweaking it to be more balanced, I think is what they said after
I
you won.
I built a farm. Just because you all didn't care about the animals doesn't mean I should be my win should be taken from me.
In any case, Endless Winter is a deck building worker placement game, which is a funny thing because it's not a term we've heard before, but now we have Endless Winter, we have Lost Winds of Arnak, and we have Dune Imperium. So this combination of mechanics mm-hmm. that we've never seen before are suddenly we're seeing three different games.
And can I just say, I've now played two of three, ooh, and I'm liking this combination of mechanics.
So I have Arnak coming my way, and I plan on reaching out to Direwolf because I want to play them all. But Endless Winter,
oh, I really want to do an Imperium,
is so far a game that I thoroughly enjoy. This is by Fantasia Games, a new publisher, but they're working with Stan Kodinsky as a designer, Johnny Pack as the lead developer and designer of two of the expansions, and I love everything about this game. Like I said, it's deck building, worker placement. You're going to be guiding your tribe across four ages of civilization, slowly but surely building up, like any good deck builder, building up the level of things you can do. You will have a fairly okay first round, followed by a pretty fun second round, followed by a feeling powerful third round, and then it's just a breaking the game and how much you get done fourth round, and it is satisfying along the way. It provides various different elements you can expand on from a camp board where you'll be trying to lock in various area control there. It has a monolith board where you'll be slowly building up these monoliths to the civilization. It has the actual deck building itself, which is a lot of fun. And then if you are Jesse, Samuel, Anderson, then you can build a farm. And all of these are viable paths to victory, and they are all so much fun to combine and contrast and figure out the optimal strategy therein.
Yeah, that's the interesting thing that's happening here in Endless Winter. You not only have a rewarding deck building system, but you have so many different modules to play in and little puzzle pieces to solve, from a little bit of set collection to a little bit of like point salads type scoring to end game scoring, victory conditions to resource conversion to a tiny bit of abstract area control, and choosing which one you play in or which few you play in during your course of the game has really been one of the most rewarding experiences of dipping back into this system. Now, Alex, it would begrudge me if we didn't take a moment to talk about the worker placement, the other half of what this game is doing, because I think they also do something really interesting in that space as well.
Yeah, so the worker placement in this one is really fascinating. Basically, what you're doing is that you get to go to a board and you get to take initially the first thing that's there. Whoever goes first gets a better result. However, the action is still open for everyone. This is not a worker placement game where you're blocking each other. It's more about getting there in a timely manner. And as you keep progressing, you'll get better bonuses and you'll start getting better things as you move along.
And each of those worker placement zones are going to relate to one of the four different regions we're talking about, from exploring to deck building to building the monolith to expanding and establishing your own tribe of people. And here's the thing that I think is really cool about what that worker placement zone does. In combination with the deck that you have in your hand, or the hand of cards that you've drawn up, you're able to take that zone that you've selected an infinite amount of times, meaning if I wanted to recruit 2, 3, or 4 different cards and I had the resources to pay for it, or if I wanted to populate the territory control board with 3 different tents and then expand them all the way across so that I'm stopping Jan from gaining meat during the eclipse phase, I'm able to do that. The agency over a limited amount of worker placement zones that then provide you with an infinite amount of potential actions, depending on how you built your deck, that combination, that cross conversation that you're having, I think is really, really good in this game.
Yeah, and other fascinating things about it is how many things it's managed to kind of cram into this design that still work pretty cohesively. You know, the deck building works really well. The tableau building works really well. The puzzle element on the monolith side is pretty fun. And there's also area control to a certain degree with also worker placement action selection. It's insane how Johnny Pack and the rest of the designers have been able to juggle all these balls in the air and make it be something incredible.
And that's why one of the things I'm very intrigued by and very excited for the Kickstarter is they have 2 expansions and 2 small modules as well. So that's even more stuff. And in a game that's this messy, and I will say messy because my one critique was it's a messy game, but I don't know how to make it less messy without taking away the fun.
I love messy games, though. I want them to be covered in chocolate fudge.
But so a game this messy, normally I'd be like, I don't know about more expansions because...
You tried these cookies?
Jesse, let me talk about Endless Winter. I am excited. I don't care about I do care about chocolate fudge cookies. I do. You know what? Pass me a cookie. I'll take one. I'm just going to hold this for a second. But these expansions, these modules, I want to see what more mess they add and how cohesively that mess works, because I can't recall the last time I've been so excited for for a game on my radar.
And Alex, while you take care of that, everybody, that's been our show. Thank you for listening, and be sure to stick around after the credits to hear our featured audience questions. Remember, if you have a question you'd like answered, swing over to theweeklyquack.com and leave a comment on this week's episode. Until then,
what if
this is Quack?
What if I have a question that I want answered?
Theweeklyquack.com and leave a comment on this week's episode.
I need to go submit.
But change your name.
Okay.
Because if not, I'm not going to pay attention to it.
Okay. I'll go ask the question there.
So until then, this is Quackalope and Board Game Co. signing off.
This latest failed attempt at bringing you quality entertainment was brought to you by the Quackalope Podcast. We love to hear from you, so don't forget to leave a review and subscribe. If you'd like to connect with us, follow us on any of our social channels or visit our website. But regardless of what you do, remember to do the important thing. Get out and play some games. Until next time.
So, audience feedback, and if anyone's interested in seeing what question I left, you're going to have to swing over to theweeklyquack.com.
Did you actually
like
leave a question?
Yeah, of course I've left a question.
Ugh.
Go,
what's the name?
Well,
tell me right now so I can just delete it.
Go check out what question I left on our own podcast. All that being said, guys, you brought in some questions, you brought in some conversation points. Let's figure out what we're talking about here.
So, today I'm going to bring in a question from Vistari. And Vistari is asking, if you were trying to convince a friend that isn't usually a fan of your favorite genre of games that it's worth another try, what game would you choose and why? My answer would be deck building and Dale of Merchants. And the reason why I would choose Dale of Merchants is because it is the most variably flexible deck builder that I have ever come across. I can form a Dale of Merchants to fit absolutely anyone's playstyle, and I think I'd be almost guaranteed that they would have a fantastic time with it.
My answer is going to be Kingdom Death, and I'm going to bring in Townsfolk Tussle.
So you mean boss monster battling?
It is, well, Kingdom Death. And I'm bringing in Townsfolk Tussle because it is a more accessible, more fun version of that dark dystopian nightmare that exists.
And for myself, I'd probably have to go with, I mean, drafting, I think, is consistently my favorite mechanic. In terms of my favorite drafting game that's most accessible, probably Bunny Kingdom, but I don't know. It's so hard. But I like Bunny Kingdom. I do like it, but it's not my favorite drafting game, but it's probably the most accessible.
Stop.
Note to self.
Stop.
One
it's
day,
amazing.
Get rid of Bunny Kingdom just to upset Alex.
It won't upset it. I mean, well,
you'd accept
it will,
me.
You know
what
do
you mean?
Do? It would, for the first time, be a game with animals, cutesy little animals that you got rid of.
Damn it. I'm not getting rid of it.
Yeah. See, I know Jesse. He's not going to do that.
And for me, my comment of the week is from Mark, who said, we are slowly but surely moving towards a special episode where all other content has been replaced by the reciting of Alex's name. Mark, I am okay with that. And to celebrate the amazing insightfulness of your comment, my current name is Alexander Sander Ratcliffe III from North Undershire, Prince 6-3, Jameson Peters, Jackson Harris. Jesse Anderson cannot take that away from me. And Mark, because you've posted this, you get to pick one of those segments and either replace or add part of my name. Just go ahead and put us a comment.
Wow.
You get to add to my
that's
name.
That's a good one.
Wow.
That's a good one. I like this trend. That's a good tradition.
I did not expect that comment to be at the end of this episode.
Can I submit one too?
You can submit it, but Mark's the one who's earned it.
Yeah, Mark's earned that.
Let's be frank. Half my name is already from the two of you. You guys have already done a decent amount of this.
It's true.
I like that. What if we add Frank to your name? Let's be Frank.
Okay. Let's be Frank. Is that going to be it? Let's be Frank.
I think we have a dangerous trend here where Alexander Sander Ratcliffe is the name given to me by my parents. I think if at any point more than three sections of my name come from any one person, that's probably a certain level of disrespect to my parents.
That is fair. We are going to have to start sourcing names from
Keep
the community
it nice and even.
Itself. Yeah. Yeah. All that being said, guys, thanks so much for joining. Do we have a sign out, or do we just ambiently fade into the darkness?
Jesse, how many times are we going to talk about this? No, there is no sign out. We just say goodbye.
There's no sign out, but I think we can all agree on one thing. Samoas.